Okay.
Absolutely.
I'll go ahead and bring it to order.
Okay. All right, well, it's 9:03, so we will call to order the Homelessness Working Group of the Special Committee on Critical Quality of Life Issues. I am co-chair Nick Howland, and with me is co-chair Dawn Gilman. And we have with us the chair of the Critical Quality of Life Issues Special Committee, Councilman Boylan. Before we get going, I just want to say this is meeting number 5 of the Working Group for Homelessness. We've had kind of an amazing run of the first 4 meetings with terrific information about homelessness in Jacksonville and around the country, all set up by my esteemed co-chair, Dawn Gilman. So she will go through exactly what we've done in the last several meetings as a reminder, because out of meeting number 5 here, we'd like to get some good discussion on what some proposals could be that come forward out of this working group to help end homelessness in Jacksonville. And that's why we're here today. So before we do get going, though, I would like to acknowledge Councilman Boylan, who I think has a few remarks for us.
I do. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank both of you for your leadership and your time and effort in putting into this. And to all of you who participated and been part of this journey for these past 10 weeks, give or take. But we're not done. But I did want to take a couple of minutes and just to clarify what happens after today. A couple of things. First of all, let me reference to the charge. And I've got a copy of it here, and it says we are to do 3 things in this process. To understand what the scope of the issue is. 2, what entities in the public, private, and nonprofit sector are doing to address these issues. And then some of the best practices around the state, around the nation, that we perhaps could bring forward as opportunities for us to address these issues. It goes on to talk about, and I want to read verbatim, these meetings will be open, available to the public to view and participate. The results and recommendations of the special committee will be provided in a report to the council at the November 22nd meeting. I need to correct that. I spoke with the council president. He's allowed us to defer it to the December 13th meeting. It gives us a little more time to put together the detailed report. I don't know that we all had an appreciation of the magnitude of this report as we go through this process. It goes on to say, to borrow a phrase from the Resiliency Committee's executive summary, the principal objective is to establish a reference guide for all the best practices, strategies, and lessons that were identified through the overall process, with an eye towards recommending policies, practices, funding, and/or funding vehicles that would greatly assist citizens that are presently burdened by such critical quality of life issues. I think I confused some folks perhaps in some of my other earlier comments. I fully expect that council members, myself, Councilmember Howland and a number of the others who have been involved in this process, will be putting forward recommendations, some of the recommendations in ordinance form or resolution form, so we have an opportunity to address these issues. And it does not preclude, and it certainly includes, many of my colleagues who have not actively participated in this, who read the report, see some of the opportunities that are before us, and to move forward on them. But I also want to remind you what I said even at the very first meeting. This will be an opportunity, by having these recommendations in hand, this will be an opportunity for us to address candidates for mayor and for city council and other constitutional seats to see where they stand on support of the recommendations coming out of this work. So I just want to make sure we clear and understand what the purpose is and what the intent was all along in this process. I know for a fact, I don't want to usurp anything or any recommendations at this point in time, but based upon some of the conversations I have heard and I have sat in on every minute of every meeting, I do believe there will be things I will be moving forward as a result of this good work of all of you. So I just wanted to share that. And again, thank you, the two of you, for your leadership in this process. And we'll go from there. And thank you for letting me get on my soapbox.
All right. Thank you, Councilman Boylan. And with that and the clear direction you just provided, I will turn it over to co-chair Dawn Gilman to talk about overview of the last 4 working group meetings. And she has some charts that we can see there.
Okay. I think I have the power now to move this forward.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yes. Okay. So just quick agenda for today. We just had our welcome and introductions. I'm going to run through the first four meetings because while there have been no formal proposals that have come out of this, there's been a lot of discussion and a lot of information about what is possible. I would like this to be a discussion because we haven't actually gone through what is out there. What could we do different? What have other communities done that has moved, as we say, moved that needle forward? And then, of course, I'm always reminded, and my co-chair will remind me that we do public comment. This is a city meeting, not a nonprofit meeting. And then closing remarks. So, Nick already did. Okay, so we have had ideas from national partners, from other communities, other local nonprofits, work group participants, and we sent out a community survey. The community survey went out to over 1,000 people. We had about a 10% response rate. So we'll go through some of, I went through that briefly, but we'll kind of talk through some of the more interesting things that came from that. So just to remind everyone, our national partners were Dr. Joe Savage from the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and then Community Solutions from K.O. Campbell from Community Solutions. Excuse me for that, mixing those two up. When you look at the two national partners, you start to see a trend that comes up. If you're going to tackle what can seem like an overwhelming issue, it does help to have specific targeted goals, to be able to measure progress towards your outcomes, not just the outputs, and use data to inform the work. I think for some of my colleagues that are in the audience that have done a lot of work with Community Solutions, the interesting thing with them is test it, right? It's okay to start something small, do a pilot, test it. Does it work? Does it not? If it doesn't, you can drop it. If it does work, keep moving forward. And then at our last meeting, we had... Did I just skip over some? Let me just make sure. Nope. We had three different communities that presented that are doing some pretty amazing work. So the first was Miami, and Manny from the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust talked about their dedicated revenue source and how that worked, and how the community-wide work has evolved over 25 years. Again, and part of that was because there is an ongoing funding stream, that whole idea of being able to test and change and grow. He specifically said when the trust first started, they primarily funded shelters. And over the years, they have found that shelters don't end homelessness, housing does. And a huge portion of their work has shifted over to working with housing authorities, working with rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing. Minneapolis also talked about a housing-focused and targeted goals. They have had a huge increase or had a huge increase in unsheltered homelessness over COVID and really rethought the way that they worked with folks who were literally outside. The shift for them is previously had primarily contracted with other nonprofits. They did start doing some of their own work. And as David talked to us, you know, one of his concerns, what they're working through, is this is primarily funded by COVID dollars, which are going away. Most of that funding is flowing through the system, and it will be sunsetting by 2024 at the latest. Atlanta, I deliberately put them last in presenting, and I really pushed Catherine to present to us because this is one of the unicorns and what people like me and my colleagues who have done this for a while have done. They were able to get a city to pass a $25 million municipal bond. They were able to get philanthropy to match it. They were able to bring in a housing authority to pledge units for 15 years, vouchers for 15 years with an option to renew. And they were able to get a county case management medical connection service to then also pledge for a number of years to make this entire package work. I will be totally honest, while I love what they have been able to do, I am not sure if this is lightning in a bottle or if this is replicable, but I think it might be worth further exploring. Because if you all remember from their presentation, and I just got it from Catherine, so it'll go out with the minutes, they have been able to exceed their goal of 200 permanent supportive housing units, and it has developed over 2,000 affordable housing units. So it is, they have, and these are real units with people who have already moved in. But again, as she mentioned, I believe this effort began in 2017, and I believe the first people moved in 2021. So none of these are quick, yeah, immediate types of things. All right. So just to remind everyone, we had several presentations. First one on meeting two, Dr. Moreland, City of Jacksonville, talked through the different funding that has gone into both or all three of the target areas, both affordable housing, homelessness, and connection to medical services. Harrison Conyers, who's here again, talked about the veteran-specific work program and that overview, and that did come up when we get to our surveys. There seems to be a lot of interest in connection with workforce development and homeless programs, which makes me think people don't realize that almost every single homeless program has a workforce development component to it, generally speaking. Pastor Barlow has been very consistent in his proposals, or his proposal, which would create a dedicated revenue source. And I gave one proposal in meeting three just to kind of ground everybody. When we talk about something that would be truly measurable, what kind of funding levels are we talking about? So the example that I gave, and I'm happy to resend that out, make sure it goes out in the minutes, is we know that there are just under 200 chronically homeless individuals in Duval County who are over 55. Right, so what would it cost to house them for 5 years? And also, what would it cost them to walk by? So Shannon Nasworth happens to be in the room. I used her study, the Ability Housing Study. I used the study out of Orlando. I used the study out of Denver. The one thing that they're very consistent with is it costs us at least $30,000 per person per year to walk by a chronically homeless individual. We are paying for it in medical. We are paying for it in police, fire, rescue, stabilization, all of the things that we put Band-Aids on to assist that person. But to help those 200 people is also not a small amount over 5 years. So I just wanted to ground that. In fact, to walk by everyone, if I'm remembering my numbers correctly, is about $26 million. To house everyone, I estimated it'd be about 13. So there is an additional cost savings. If I was in charge of all of that, I would actually put this cost savings into building more permanent supportive housing, but that, of course, I'm not in charge of all the $26 million. I'm just letting people know where that is. But I think it is important to remember, while we talk about what do we invest, we are already investing as a community, but probably in ways that aren't particularly effective. So then we sent out a community survey. If you've ever volunteered for us, if you've ever been to one of our meetings, we probably got your email address. We sent out this to you. And our first question was, what would you do if there was multi-year funding? So just about 106 people answered. Only 3 people skipped this question. So of the people that responded to the survey, They cared deeply. They went all the way through the survey. This is incredibly hard to read, but the first one is that permanent supportive housing for 55 and plus, a diversion or problem-solving program, a rapid rehousing program for folks that are literally homeless, and the fourth one that was actually the overwhelming winner was can we do system support? Can we support the whole system and plug it into where we need it most flexibly? Which would include all of those three things above at some level. Oop. I think.
There's one more, it looks like.
I know.
The trick's getting
yeah, there we go. There. All right. So this is just before we have the discussion. To me, the common trends in all of this is there's got to be some sort of reoccurring or known multi-year revenue source for any of the programs, whether it was the ones that Joe Savage talked about in North Carolina where they built permanent supportive housing, whether it's a rapid rehousing program, diversion, or just system-wide. If there is some level of consistency as a system, we can develop what we need. We can hire the people to do the work, and we know that when we bring someone into a system, there is enough money to help them get housed. The other common theme is that targeted and measurable outcomes and goals. Again, when we say, let's end homelessness, that's a huge number of people. It often just overwhelms anyone when we think about it. We know that on our by name list right now, we have over 3,000 people. That's just a lot. We're in a very tight rental market. We all get that. We see that. But again, what if we could just look at how about those people that are chronically homeless and over 55? Could we target them? Could we decide we don't want any child sleeping on our streets? Could we target that? Could we say we think we can get the best bang for our buck for people that are first-time homeless? Can we bounce them up and out? And they'll never, if we can get them restabilized, they won't need our system again. These are all possibilities that other communities have done. There was nothing that was presented that could not be done in Jacksonville. All of them are within the skill sets of the nonprofits that work here. And I think if you look at the track record over the past 10 years, when we do get funding, we can do amazing things with it. But it is not, I would also say, as when we had Councilperson Salem here, there's nobody left within our system that just has extra capacity. There's no, as we joke about, there's no empty 500-unit apartment complex of all one bedrooms, which is actually what we could really use. It does not exist right now, but we can figure out how to, as we like to say, move that needle. So with that, I'm going to pause for questions and discussion on that. One hand went right up. Yes.
Okay,
please do, because that, yep, and say your name. Is it name and address?
Yeah, and we've got an hour and 40 minutes on the agenda where it's just going to be a proposal and priority discussion, and then we'll do a public comment period where actual name cards have to be submitted. But until then, it's free for all. Let's have a discussion.
Excellent. My name is Angela McKee. I'm at 8833 Perimeter Park. I represent City Rescue Mission and the National Association of Residential Property Managers. I've had the pleasure of attending your meetings and the other meetings, and I will tell you, out of all of them, the work, Don, that you have done and presented is amazing.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about Atlanta being the unicorn. I will tell you, as I listened to that presentation last week, it felt doable because we can put those dollars together, we can work with local businesses. But here's a concern that I have. Is I don't want to see a Band-Aid of just housing the homeless. I want to make sure that we're caring for those that need it with the case management. So any proposal that's put forth, I really want to make sure that we're continuing with someone who might have disabilities, mental addictions, and other things where you're helping them to sustain and to grow. So I just want to make sure as we're putting that out there that we're putting case management as a priority along with the housing.
That is excellent. As someone who writes these budgets for this, generally speaking, it's at least 60% housing, 40% for the case management. If you're literally moving people off the street, it has to be very intensive case management. I will defer to some of my other colleagues that run permanent supportive housing. It can be even higher just with the level of medical care that some folks need.
Great point. Thank you very much. Yes, please. Make any guest appearance?
Yes. I'm Sherry Weber, 302 East 2nd Street, Springfield resident. I am not speaking on behalf of At-Large Group 4 right now, just me. My question is, has anyone had any thoughts or conversation around Duval County schools that have been campuses that are historic and have been outgrown, and the school board has designated these as no longer appropriate for conducting classes? Many of these have already moved students to other campuses. A lot of these show up on Jacksonville Historic Society's endangered list. They're still viable buildings, but your comment that we don't have a just 500-unit apartment building that's empty sitting around waiting for someone to fill it up. So just wondering if anybody has thought about that as a potential resource or collaboration point.
Yeah, I think, I think two people in the audience have looked at historical schools.
Shannon, if you want to come up and talk about it. As a matter of fact, that actually did take place, and it was a bit of a struggle to get it through land use and zoning because of the neighborhood. So, Shannon, you can speak to that.
Hi, I'm Shannon Nesmith with Ability Housing. And I do agree that we should look at all of our vacant buildings and anything that can be an adaptive reuse, we should look at for whether it's an emergency shelter or ideally permanent housing, because in the end, it's permanent housing that's going to be the ultimate solution with services. 100% agree we have to make sure that there are the supports necessary to keep the people stably housed and successful. I will say, you know, operating several hundred permanent supportive housing units every year, if the service needs do decline over time as they stabilize, and we have actually graduated people out of permanent supportive housing. So one of my recommendations would be, as we look holistically at this, is creating a system with that flow. If you don't want to have the end point and then think it's over, because you want to get people completely out of the system, completely self-sufficient, so that somebody else can then take that unit and, you know, you have flow throughout the system. I will say, using Lake Forest Elementary as the example, I think one of the major recommendations I would have is we've got to have the political will to do this, especially if you're talking about creating housing for the homeless. There is not a neighborhood in this community that's going to jump up and down and say, yes, please, here. Yeah. Every single community will come out with reasons of their own that are all, in the end, pre-identical as to why their neighborhood is not the right neighborhood. It's not that it's not good. It's not that it's not needed. It's not that it's not. It's not that it's not. It's not that it's not. Except right here. You know, we have service needs in our neighborhood. We have traffic needs. It's going to overwhelm the school. It's going to overwhelm this. Or sometimes they're very honest and just say, and I'm quoting directly, I don't want that riffraff in my neighborhood. Or worse. So it is going to take a lot of political will to really think about the thousands of people in need and not just the 10 people who are in the room. I think that's one of the biggest recommendations I would have. In addition to, we need dedicated resources. You know, Atlanta's not the only community that's done a municipal bond. It has been done other places. It is a huge leverage of resources. It can be done very, you know, wisely, especially if you're able to get philanthropy to lean in as well. But there's other resources that can be layered with those bonds. And just if you keep that production and keep that moving, you know, it really will create, over time, a real pipeline of projects. I would also strongly recommend, if the city is putting any money into any project whatsoever, and I don't care if it's affordable housing or not, there needs to be something for the homeless in there. And maybe they have to put dollars aside to go into some fund, but if they're going to fund large economic development projects or affordable housing, some of the units should be set aside for the homeless, or resources dedicated to help create those problems.
Shannon, could you speak a little bit about what you're doing at the site up on the north side in terms of making available affordable housing or workforce housing, if you will, for people who work in DCPS, and also the daycare center and other child support efforts that are going to be part of that initiative?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those who aren't aware, we work with DCPS. We're going to be acquiring Lake Forest Elementary, which was closed several years ago due to declining population. Our original desire had been to do an adaptive reuse and use this existing structure, but it's really not configured well for housing. It just can't be reconfigured as housing smartly, so we're going to demo and build new. It'll be 120 apartments. We've set aside 25% of the units for DCPS personnel. This is huge for them. They're having major problems recruiting and retaining personnel, not just teachers, but bus drivers, as we've heard on the news. They're competing with Amazon and everyone else for drivers. So, you know, they're really looking at this as a recruiting and retention tool and just something that's desperately needed for their personnel in addition to the community as a whole. This project isn't one that we had originally intended to have any units set aside for the homeless, but as with all of our projects, we will always open up units. And we are working with the city to fill gaps on the project because since we started this 2 years ago, construction costs and interest rates have gone up just a hair. It's been a fun roller coaster ride. But and on site working with DCPS, we're going to have an early learning center so that anybody in the neighborhood who wants to send their child to an early learning center will be there. We've also, at other projects, been working with a national nonprofit, opening free Montessori-like preschools at our properties. So we're working with them to see other locations. We have another project on the west side we're going to be doing. We want to see if maybe they'd locate there. Because really, in the end, our projects, we want to be part of the broader neighborhood and benefiting the whole community and not just the residents. We want those residents to be part of a thriving neighborhood and for the neighborhood to have access to the resources we're bringing to the community. All of our projects, whether targeting the homeless or not, are always open to people who have experienced homelessness. We will never discriminate based on somebody's homeless status. You know, just because you're a daycare worker who is living in your car doesn't mean you shouldn't be allowed to live in our housing. You can meet all other criteria. But of course, given our mission, we're always striving to make units more affordable, you know, extremely low barriers for entry. We're pretty lenient, and we haven't seen any issues with that. You know, landlords have concerns, but honestly, in fact, we're talking with a nonprofit out of Miami. They have no screening criteria whatsoever, and they're not having problems with it. Just sound property management and good case management.
And Shannon, while you're up here, what Sherry talked about was something that's kind of a non-traditional adaptive use of a school property. We're also seeing in the city non-traditional adaptive use of hotel properties to affordable housing. There's a number of projects going on. And can you talk about that? And is that a national trend? I know it's more of an affordable housing issue, but you brought up the point that sometimes these affordable housing projects can also have a homeless component.
Absolutely. And yes, it is a national trend. It can be, and as with any model, it comes to the implementation. It can be done incredibly successfully, and it can be done really not so well. And I'm thinking of a project in Orlando that has struggled for probably 20 years now. Mm-hmm. It was a large motel that was converted to permanent supportive housing. And the reason it didn't work, to the prior point, is they didn't have enough resources for the supports. They just don't have the robust on-site supports that they needed to have that number formerly chronically homeless persons. Living at one property. And that's why the supports are really necessary in making sure the project has enough operating support, whether it's through rental assistance or recurring guaranteed finger quoting. But if you're going to do one of these projects and you're going to be renting to people who can only afford $100 a month, there needs to be other resources coming in because the insurance alone is going to suck that up, let alone maintenance and everything else. So, you know, you need to make sure you have the resources to make the project successful. Because in the end, as Don said, it is more expensive to, like, leave people homeless.
Yeah.
We did our study in 2015 to 2017, mm-hmm. and it was literally 30% less expensive, including the cost of the housing assistance and the on-site support services, to house individuals than it was to maintain their homelessness. So it's a wise financial decision, and even if it broke even, it's a better quality of life for both the person and the city as a whole.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are ways to do this. We've just got to get smart. And the other part is look across silos.
Mm-hmm.
The savings are in the healthcare system. The savings are in the criminal justice system. They're going to have to help contribute to the solutions.
Thank you.
Cindy.
Speaker has said about the wraparound services. Yes, you can put somebody in housing, but are they going to be there in 12 months or 18 months? So the wraparound services are critical. One thing we haven't, Shannon mentioned it, but the healthcare piece, which I know is a separate committee, but housing, healthcare, we call it HOPE, which is income, all of those things are part of the wraparound and they need to be considered when we're looking at that. Reoccurring funding, absolutely critical. One thing I didn't hear, which I believe the Atlanta model had in place, was that partnership with the Housing Authority.
Mm-hmm.
setting aside homeless preference and a certain number of vouchers through COVID. We've had that because a bunch of new vouchers came down. But historically, we've tried to work with the Housing Authority here for decades, and they have not wanted to play ball with setting aside homeless preference vouchers, which happens in, you know, cities all over the country. And we really need those vouchers, ongoing source of those vouchers as well, if we're going to make a robust change. So I'd like to see that somehow being included, because this is the time, the best time to do it is now. So
yeah.
I just wanted to point that out.
And I want to just, before the next person comes up, just piggyback on that, because there's two really incredibly powerful use of those, what's known as Section 8 vouchers, and there's other vouchers that are coming down that the Housing Authority will be applying for. There's two really good uses of those. One, Shannon mentioned, that it's called a move-up strategy. So in the continuum of care, we have a certain number of permanent supportive housing units. As Shannon mentioned, many of those people have been in permanent supportive housing for 5+ years. They have stabilized. They really don't need most of our supports, that really high level of supports. They do need the voucher. They just do not have that income. If we can move them into a less restrictive, same apartment, just less restrictive, we are able to move new people into the permanent supportive housing units that have all of the case management, that have the connections to the medical, the mental health, any whatever else is needed. The second piece that is really helpful is if we had a pledge from the Housing Authority and a pledge for ongoing case management assistance, then you can create more permanent supportive housing units. Again, that is something that many communities do, one, the other, or both. It's a matter of what is the greatest need at the time and people flowing through that system. As we have looked more and more at our system, we have gotten better at realizing what the inflow and outflow is, and our whole goal is to move people through to the least restrictive possible place that needs, where they can do whatever it is they want to do in their lives.
If I could interject just very quickly, again, being sitting in on each and every of these meetings, there was a presentation at the Access to Healthcare meeting about an entity in Miami Gardens that was created to help that area, which led to a conversation of KHA and the prospect of a KHA model that when we speak about wraparound services, and I'm not advocating this, I'm just sharing with you because I want to get your feedback on this. If we created an entity like KHA that takes a whole wraparound focus on helping children and the coordination of the nonprofits that do that kind of work, does it make sense here to look at a vehicle that allows us to create an entity that wakes up every day focusing on these critical quality of life issues and making sure that the wraparounds and all that's happening is addressed? So I just toss that out there for conversation. You may not love the idea, might hate the idea, but I wanted to share with you that there was a conversation in the other groups about a standing entity that focuses on these three issues.
So I'm familiar with the Miami Gardens, and they do great work, and they're also directly connected to the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, which means they're providing the health care, and there is a place for them to access housing. So, again, it comes back to if there is a countywide entity that is going to look at the critical qualities of life, these three issues, how are they going to be funded?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a Kids Hope Alliance that has a little bit of funding, but I would argue not necessarily enough to make the impact it would like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, as someone who is a lead entity for three counties, absolutely, we would work with them, we would support them, but what's the goal? Like, I guess that's what I've said in a lot of these meetings. I know Shannon's probably got some deep thoughts on this also. She's worked with many different communities across the state. What's the goal? What's the problem we want to solve? Mm-hmm. Right? What specifically, either in each of these three different areas or in a combined way, do we want to solve? And how are we going to create that political will? Because Shannon is right. It is hard to cite any structure that has the words affordable or homeless in it. And make sure that both components are there, or all three components are there, the housing, the case management, and that hope or that income piece. There are many SAMHSA grants that come out that are offering large amounts of money for the mental health component, and you have to magically come up with the 200 units of housing, right? But there's never a connect between two to make that program whole. I will also send to you, I just read it today, it's a New York Times in-depth article looking at Los Angeles and their $1 billion tax bond issue and what the barriers are, right? Like, yes, they'll put up $125,000 per unit, but in no way will the county city fund an entire unit. And they went through how they have added years onto the development piece because it wasn't just, we will give you $15 million to build this project and the entity could just build the project. Mm-hmm. So the levels of coordination can be good and that you get everyone involved. But there has to be an incentive for everybody to come to the table without causing 14 more layers of reporting responsibilities.
I hearken back to my time as the chair of the long-term recovery after Hurricane Irma, and we were remarkably successful in securing national grants because we demonstrated the interactivity mm-hmm. of the nonprofits and the work that they were doing. So I'm not, again, advocating it. I just wanted to bring it to the table as part of the conversation.
I will say, Shannon, as we're building housing again, I will say what I do think is at the core of what you're recommending and something that we desperately need in the communities that really have thrived and moved the needle on this. We have, you know, Changing Homelessness as our continuum of care lead agency, and it has some community members on the board. But honestly, it's operating in its own homeless continuum
right.
of care problem.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be part of a broader system. Mm-hmm. And the communities that have really thrived are the ones where they have that entity as an equal part of a larger community board. And I will say I've worked in Orlando for 7 years now. you know, and they just got last week, I think it was, Secretary Fetch came to town to give them $8 million for homeless youth because they have what they call the Central Florida Commission on Homelessness. It's a tri-county body chaired by the mayors. But it is the business leaders, it's the faith leaders, it's the continuum of care, it's the nonprofits, it's the housing authority, it's the United Way, it's the funders. It's all of the sectors that have to be part of the solution and coordinating and knowing what each other's doing, creating strategic objectives, again, going to those targeted measurable outcomes. The continuum of care and its members have to be a thriving part of that, but they can't do it on their own. And so having the local city governments, and in this instance it's a tri-county, but here it could just be Duval County if you so chose, just having the elected officials, the mayor's office, the city council, but also the business leaders mm-hmm. and the faith leaders and the funders at the table working cohesively on strategies and holding each other accountable and helping each other be successful. In the end, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take everybody realizing what they bring to the table and then implementing those things to move the needle on homelessness. The communities that have done this have done that really, really well. And it could be a KHA-type thing, or it could just be more of a, you know, I don't know if you need to form a 501c3 to support it or just have an official body. You know, it's been done different ways in mm-hmm. different communities. It really just comes down to the leadership commitment as to mm-hmm. whether it's successful.
Well, I fully expect, and I'm not speaking fully for myself, but I'm sure Councilman Holland and others will be actively marketing the recommendations of this group within the nonprofit sector, or the for-profit sector specifically, the Chamber, the Civic Council, you know, et cetera. So let them understand this is something we all have to deal with. And that's why we're very intentional in talking about private, public, and nonprofit sector in all of our conversations up to this point in time, because it's not going to be solved by one leg of the stool.
I will say a few years ago, literally just before COVID hit, the United Way, the Community Foundation, and Jesse Ball DuPont funded a study of our continuum of care, and there were specific recommendations in there. I would definitely look at those. But this kind of You can't just have the siloed nonprofits working amongst themselves. You've got to have the broader community and dedicating resources. I mean, in the end, it takes resources. We're spending the money, as Don has said multiple times over the last several weeks. We're spending the money. We need to spend it better. But we also need to spend more because it's going to take resources. But in the end, the investment will be a huge ROI.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Noel Como, Director of Policy and Planning for the Northeast Florida Regional Council. For those of you who don't know, we're supporting development of this, thanks to Councilman Boylan. Point of clarification for Shannon and or Dawn, you've mentioned earlier 200 at 55 years and older, mm-hmm. and then you just mentioned 200 units. What's the just to ask, what's the total number of homeless in Duval?
So it's always interesting when we get asked the total number. Like, it's like this, there, it is not a static number of individuals. There, as of 2 weeks ago, on our full by name list, there were, I believe, 3,400 plus individuals. That means those are people that we know who are experiencing homelessness in Duval, Clay, and Nassau County. The overwhelming percentage of folks are in Duval County, and they're throughout our county. Yes, we tend to get a lot of calls from downtown, but people live throughout the county. It's everywhere. A new person literally showed up as I saw them for the first time walking my dog this weekend, right? So it's in all parts of our county. When we do a by name list, what we're looking for is who is currently homeless, and then we attempt to match them with services. What we consistently come up with is there are not enough services to match to those people. If you happen to be a veteran, we can probably help you, right? That if you are literally homeless and a veteran, there's probably a way that we can much more rapidly offer assistance because it is funded to a much greater level than the general population. So on that by name list of over 3,000 individuals, we also know of over 200, even that said, we know of about 200 veteran households who are literally homeless, right? So when I talk about, yes, we have about 200 chronically homeless individuals who are 55 and plus, most of those folks, because of their age and their disabilities, and our lack of permanent supportive housing, because that's what all those 200 folks actually qualify for if we were to have it, they are more likely to die on our streets than to get permanent supportive housing. In a good month, we maybe have 10 to 12 openings in permanent supportive housing. Since COVID, we're one of that permanent supportive housing that the agencies operate are one of the last stopgaps, right? Like we're not charging more for people to live there. We are covering those costs. We are negotiating with landlords to try to maintain those leases. So as Shannon said, in Orlando, when they have this large group of folks who are, it's the city, it's the county, it's the nonprofits, it's the faith community, it's the philanthropists, when they meet, they're not going into the stuff that I have to worry about as the COC lead to tell you, like, due to CRF 562.1.2.A, we got to do it this way. They're looking at what's the total number of people, how many flowed into our system, and how many were we able to house, and who are the folks that are left. What do we need to look at? Are we starting to see a change in who we're seeing? So we need to rethink, like, in the next year or 2 years, what we do differently. It's always a process of moving that needle forward, looking at the actual data.
I'm going to ask a clarifying question, and that is the over 3,000, let's say, for example, which I find personally big because my parents live in a 10,000-person hometown, small town once, that's a third of the town, right? The 3,000 are individuals, and the other part of that question is, how many, a rough percent to help people understand, is what percent is children?
So the best data on that comes from the ESGCV, where we were moving people directly off the streets and into hotels. To move into a hotel, you had to be literally homeless, and a member of your household had to have an underlying medical condition. So in doing that, somewhere between 10 and 15% of everybody that we moved into hotel was a household with minor children. So households with minor children are a small percentage of the total, but a very concerning percentage. When we, as a system, do prioritizations, the reason you keep hearing those two groups is the two things that we prioritize the most are young, single head of households with young kids. That means 25 and under with minor kids. And then folks who have a disability who are 55 and up. It is difficult for those two groups, if they fall into homelessness, to regain housing, and they need additional supports different than other groups to maintain that housing.
Real quick, just want to add, to throw kudos over here to my co-chair, Don Gilman. So besides preparing us for these working groups, putting together all these presentations, running Changing Homelessness this weekend, she found rapid emergency shelter for a female veteran and her two children. And that's what she does on a daily basis. So we're lucky to have the expert right here, and I just wanted to give her a shout-out. We think it was a great accomplishment that the Jags won. To me, it's far more of a great accomplishment that we put a female who served our country and the two children under a shelter immediately. And thanks, Dawn, for doing that. Actually, while we're on data, one more question following along the lines of Noelle's. You mentioned $30,000 in cost for, I think you said that was for per person per year for chronically homeless. How can you break that down when you say $30,000 at a high level? You know, is that in $10,000 healthcare, $10,000?
So
the law enforcement. And
funny you should mention it. I was a panelist at a symposium on Friday going, you know, over payees. So most of that is healthcare, right? The overwhelming largest expense, and Shannon, what, 30, at least 30% of that 30,000? Do you remember the breakdown? So when you look at the costs, we're looking, if you look at healthcare, that would include ambulance rides, that would include ER visits. If you're diabetic and on the streets, you don't have refrigerators, you don't have your insulin, so when you crash, you take an ambulance ride to the ER, you've probably crashed enough that, congratulations, you graduated into ICU, which is stunningly expensive. So when we talk about this, this is consistent across the country. Like, that amount is, and this was, most of those studies are pre-COVID, it could have actually gone up more because of less access to healthcare. It is enough that the large county hospital in Los Angeles has purchased an apartment building because it's less expensive for them to own an apartment, to move in homeless clients that are cycling in and out of their ER and hospital.
I don't remember what the cost breakdown was. I can say the savings breakdown, over 60% was in the healthcare system. You know, people seem to think it's a cold, rainy night, so they're going to the ER. They're being hospitalized. They have real medical issues.
Yeah.
And the hospital's doing the best they can, no criticizing at all. But eventually they're released, and they're released back to the streets. And a lot of the times, a lot of our residents will say they're not even letting them know they're homeless because they're afraid they'll get kicked out or something. They don't understand. And so, they're just cycling in and out. It could be CSU units, detox, but it's mostly hospitalization, and it's because they don't have any kind of preventative care or access to medication, or, you know, when the camps get tossed, all their medication gets tossed, and that becomes highly problematic. The jails the sheriff's office was really happy with us. We had an over 80% reduction in jail nights and arrests for misdemeanor offenses. You know, so, but the biggest is the healthcare system. And I'll send you guys the executive summary. But I can send you the three-page executive summary.
We also know, too, in the most recent budget, as you know, Councilman Howland, $40 million in indigent care to UFL.
Yep.
It was 30 last year. And also the MHOP program we could talk about, too, as an example that's helping a lot in this process.
And I will say, whatever the solution is, as you're working on hopefully some sort of community body to help bring cross-sector solutions to this issue, the healthcare system has to be part of it. In Central Florida, they have one of the largest national nonprofit healthcare systems headquartered outside of Orlando. So they're part of this system. And one of the reasons we ended up in Orlando is they asked us to work with them, and we built a 75-unit apartment community, partly to help them with some of their highest-need individuals who are cycling in and out. And so the healthcare system is realizing how much this is costing them. They need ways that they can plug in and help create solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Cindy, and then I just want to say, yes, it was great that we could get that mom and her two kids off the street on a Sunday, and they you know, after sleeping in their car. What haunts me and why I'm pushing for consistent investment in the entire system is that was the anomaly. Like, that email got to me. I have the staff that is able to make it happen, and it was one, right? But there are more, and there are more that we don't necessarily know about or that we just do not have the resources to move that quickly. So thank you for that. But, you know, there's also others out there, and we need to get as good as we are in that veteran, which there's still, like, someone who runs a large veteran program, there is plenty of room for improvement, but we have to get that good for the whole system.
Yeah, and I should have shouted out to Dee Caronto, who is here with her leadership team. That's Northeast Florida Women Veterans, who do an amazing job taking care of female veterans, not just from a housing perspective, from a holistic perspective, getting them connected to services that they need. And I wish I could have said that while they were here, but it'll at least go on the record.
I just wanted to address the health piece of this. So I was at your same conference. I'm sorry I missed your panel. But 2 weeks prior to that, I was at the Duval County Medical Society conference, and I spoke, and the presentation was called Housing is Healthcare. Mm-hmm. Not only are health systems investing in housing, the major insurers, United Healthcare has built 8,500 units across the country already. Humana is building, Paul Sapia, who was mm-hmm. only a, so they are already building housing in Florida. We just really need to get them to Jacksonville because they're not building it here. But so it isn't just health systems. It's the major insurers. And it does behoove them because when you're looking at the cost, you know, there's a lot of pilots that I found around the country where major insurers were piloting permanent supportive housing and supportive housing for elderly and people like that. The savings are amazing, but more importantly for me, the outcome, the health outcomes for the people that they're serving, it's a win-win for everybody. We talk a lot about savings and dollars. These are people. These are people. So we're actually, you know, we really need to be looking at that piece of the equation, which isn't dollars and cents, but we're saving people's lives and helping people. So the social determinants of health is something I know, Michael, you've heard a lot about it. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it. The insurers are looking at this now as part of the value-based healthcare system. And, you know, 80% of all health is something that's outside of what the doctor sees in the doctor's office. They recognize that now. Housing, nutrition, violence, all of those things. And so the healthcare system is really coming on board with this right now. It's a great time to get them at the table, because obviously it behooves them.
Well, at this point, probably a great break to shift the discussion into what could be some proposals or priorities moving forward. And I do want to ask Councilman Boylan, I believe during the budget process, we set aside some money for proposals coming out of,
well,
I forget the amount and the final result.
Well, the ask was significant.
Yeah.
It was cut down dramatically.
Yeah.
But I do have a commitment both from the council president and the administration that they will support some support here. My greatest concern, obviously we're talking policy, we're talking about creating structure. I don't want that 55-year-old homeless person to be 65 before they see any kind of results in this process.
Good
so
point.
I fully expect there may be some Band-Aid support in the short term as we solve the long-term problem. But there is a commitment to do that on the part of the current administration and council leadership.
Well, maybe we could structure some priorities or proposals in a time horizon. So what could be a short-term, if we're going to have the final brief out in December, what could be a Q1 calendar year 2023 short-term proposal? What could be a medium term through the rest of 2023, and what could be a long term, you know, something that gets into the budget and gets funded in a multi-year perspective, to Dawn's point. So we could look at short, medium, and long term. And there are, I mean, to start the discussion off on some short term issues, we have the baseline in the data. We know there's 3,000 chronically or 3,000 folks experiencing homelessness, mostly across Duval, Clay, and Nassau, but mostly in Duval. Some of the things I heard early on in this discussion when we did the game was how people move through the system. And Dawn, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things that I heard was that we're not, a lot of our emergency shelters are not at full capacity. And one of the discussion points that came on early on could be, how do we drive more folks, more of those folks that at any given time are unsheltered out there when we do a point count, to the emergency shelters? Could that be a short-term solution? That could be an education thing or something where we lower the barriers that has come up a couple times during the five working groups. Is educating people and lowering barriers to increase capacity utilization at our current shelters, could we make a short-term recommendation out of that?
So we have I've looked at this many different times. As we move forward, it's important to remember that if we have five different major shelters, they are all five separate corporations with five separate boards of directors who legally get to make their own decisions on what happens within that structure. That is, you know, within certain fairly broad parameters. When we go out and talk to folks who are homeless, whether it be an outreach team, case management, the folks that hang around any of our buildings anyone we talk to, the majority of persons who are homeless are very aware of the shelters downtown, mm-hmm. regardless of where they are within Duval County. There are many reasons an individual or family may choose not to go into shelter. If we want to make shelters more low barrier, then the city would have to incentivize them. Right now, the funding that goes directly to emergency shelters, the majority of it is either through the Emergency Solutions Grant or through the Public Services Grant. I just looked at who was awarded on PSG. I know the regulars on ESG for those grants. There's not a whole heck of a lot of shelter money. Most of the shelters are fundraising funds directly from individuals. My agency also has a grant that can support shelters. It gives a stunning $14 a night per person, and I believe $2.50 per served meal, right? Like that, I started, the first time I administered that grant was in 2008. It hasn't changed since then, right? So if you are asking shelters to be more low barrier, they will need more staff, trained staff, and they will probably need to change configurations of the physical building that people are in. Again, it can be done. I think there are several shelter directors that would be interested in doing it. They know who they are, whether it's a mission or a municipal shelter. There's examples across the country of doing it. But we have to understand that, again, there is some cost in making those kinds of changes. 10 years ago, I would say it was, you know, a philosophical difference and no one would do it. At this point, I think we've done enough work that people, especially when City Rescue Mission did the temporary bridge shelter. That was a 24/7 come-as-you-are shelter. They did it. They did it well. And they were exhausted. I mean, there was a reason we could not extend it. It wasn't the funding or the physical building. It was there weren't enough people to man that. And we couldn't get trained personnel to do it. So there's a whole, as we wish to make change in the system, we've got to support the whole system to make those changes and make them successfully.
What are the barriers we're talking about lowering to increase capacity utilization at a shelter?
Background checks, sobriety checks, people that some shelters still require religious services. Some shelters require you to hand them all their possessions, and people don't want to give it up. Most people who are homeless have been assaulted on the street, so they have weapons. Weapons are not allowed in any of our shelters. Some shelters make you hand them their prescriptions. Some shelters have you keep their prescriptions. Prescriptions get lost and stolen. Many people have companion animals that are either therapy animals or just their pets. They don't want to give up their pets. If you are a single dad with girls, we only have one shelter that has two shelters that have rooms that can handle that. If you are a single mom with boys over the age of 9, we don't have the same two shelters. That's all we got that can handle those. Those family rooms are full every night. That is the one place we are that it's a struggle. If you're married, you can't stay in the same room. You have to separate on a men's and women's side. Well, except for one. I have two kids, and if my son is 18 and my daughter is 14 and I was homeless, where would I go where all three of us could stay together? I mean, most of our shelters were built in a time when the overwhelming persons that were homeless were single adult males. They're built, any shelter, Sulzbacher is the newest shelter, and that was built in 95, right? So they were built for the situation at the time, and now it's very different.
You also mentioned that you don't see knowledge of the five shelters as a concern among the homeless community in Duval County?
Pastor Barlow wants to talk about it. I think Cindy has a HOPE team to talk about it. We have teams that go out throughout the three-county area. We talk to the folks. You know, panhandling comes up. We have a crew that's on the corner right where our offices is. We've talked to them all. They are very familiar with all the shelters, and they have a place where they go at night. So it's there are some perceptions out among the homeless folks that are their perceptions, and then there's some that are real true barriers to get to. Can we work with the perception issues? Sure. But those real barriers, that takes real change to make a difference.
Pastor?
Alvin Wellington Barlow, 625 West Union Street, and that's right across the street from one of the shelters. And I'm blessed to serve on this Be Plan Minister dinner on Sunday, preached yesterday, as a matter of fact, on the corner of Union and Broad. And Cindy Funkhauser asked me several meetings ago, you know, she said, well, we have beds available, you know, try to find out, you know, why they're not going. And it is a myriad of reasons why she's articulated every last one of them.
Yeah.
But there are some additional reasons that I'm not at liberty to discuss. Some of them are criminal. Some of them are equitable and constitutional issues that their rights are being violated. And there are some certain issues that are as simple as this right here. When people bring in donations, okay, from events or whatever, clothing, food, whatever, there's a complaint a lot of times that the people who work in these shelters, who are homeless themselves, but they work in the shelters, they'll take priority over the best things and they'll leave the trash for everybody else. That's a complaint that I've heard for years. I've seen it, as a matter of fact, before I even got involved in this issue. I saw it personally after a class reunion that we had in 1999, and we donated the rest of the food to one of the missions. And the next day when I came to donate some more food, somebody said, well, we're not going to get it. I'm like, what are you talking about? You brought some food yesterday, right? I'm like, yeah. So they divided that food amongst the people who work here. We're not going to get it. So I serve them right there in the parking lot. So it's a lot of issues like that. But there are some people who would rather sleep outside than to suffer the degradation and the abuse that they suffer at the hands of people. And these people have been, you know, treaded upon their lives, throughout their lives, and now they're in a position of power, authority, and influence. And they will haze or take it out on some of those other people. So we have women, and yes, there are people who have trained dogs who assist them and everything. So we're buying dog food for dogs and everything else because they're owned by the homeless people. But they will not stay in the shelter for a myriad of reasons, most of which is very well articulated.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Makes sense. Ms. Funkhauser, yeah?
Oh,
okay.
Go ahead. Carnell, address is on file. I want to just like highlight a number of things. As I walk around the downtown area and I see the homeless population, y'all keep count of the population, and I see the different programs and organizations. Some of them are a real headache. Trinity is a headache. City Rescue Mission is a headache. Schausbacher doesn't have all that extra stuff that they do. I'm not trying to kiss nobody, but what I'm saying is that it's a lot more easier to deal with an organization that does not require a lot of restraints. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more easy. Faith-based organizations are a real headache. They make you go to church, and they're supposed to serve the community. If they're supposed to serve the community, then they need to serve the community. Don't make me sit through a church service, then allow me to go upstairs and sleep. I've been through some of these organizations. The homeless population knows which ones are the worst ones. Trinity. But the women's section is probably the best institution. We're along with Salvation Army for the women and children. The thing about it is that we need uniformity. If PSG dollars are going to organizations that are faith-based, they need to level their playing ground. When you talk about systematic factors like background checks and things of that nature, there may need to be some criteria worked out on the state level and on local level to clean that up. But on a state and federal level, there's got to be more money coming down because all that responsibility is going to come bearing down because you got to pay attention. I'm watching meth and I'm watching Molly. I'm seeing more young people homeless on the streets. The family's done giving up on them, and they don't have no place to go. No place. So that dollar amount, as you try to target it, a population of our senior citizens, you're going to see a population of our young people grow enormous. And you can't just focus on the moment at hand. You got to look at it in a holistic standpoint. I'm seeing it with my own two eyes, and it's growing. And a lot of them are them white boys coming from the west side. I'm not trying to be racist, but people who grow up in rural parts of town, they be more victimized by more severe drugs. And those that are coming from the Molly epidemic, they are coming from Kings Road corridor because it's blowing up out of yin yang. A 16-year-old running up and down the street because he can't keep his hat together, his mom then gave up on him. But at the same time, you have a mother get kicked out of a house, things of that nature. This mess is a lot more worse than what y'all think that you can focus on. And I yield my time on that. But if y'all can work on funding.
Carnell, you losing your voice?
I was at the Jaguar game.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you gotta save it for Wednesday night, right? Council meeting. Thank you. Thanks, Carnell. Well, actually, that brings up a good term because Carnell just mentioned families don't have a place to go. I heard Pastor Barlow mention it and Don Gilman mention it. I wonder if maybe there's, but yet we might be over capacity in some of our individual beds. I wonder if there's any short-term solution we can do to help one, two, maybe all five of the five shelters convert anything from a financial perspective from individual to a family room, and therefore maximize capacity. I defer to someone that actually runs a shelter.
But I can tell you, because we did use a lot of hotel rooms. So when people think, oh, that would be a great solution. So as a person who's written a lot of checks for that, if you want to keep five hotel rooms for a year, that will cost you $100,000. If you want to do 30 hotel rooms for a full year, that will cost you just over $1 million. So that's $400 a week times the number of rooms times the number of weeks. So this is a quick fix. I will also tell you, we are now, as far as the hotel motel industry, we are fully out of the COVID epidemic, right? While we probably kept many hotels in business that first year and a half, their business model is back, and we are being charged full fare.
Realized Cindy Funkhauser, 1352 Plantation. Sorry. Just wanted to piggyback on what Cornell was saying, because one thing you didn't mention, one reason a lot of people won't come into shelter is because they're so severely mentally ill that they cannot tolerate a congregate environment where you have a bunch of people living in a room. It's too much stimulation, can't handle it. That's why the MHOP program, the Mental Health Offender Program, where we do utilize hotels. We take people off the street immediately, but they're never going into our congregate shelter because they can't tolerate that. And that's a pretty large percentage of people. So when we built Sulzbacher Village for women and families, we have no congregate shelter. We have individual, they're like hotel rooms, individual rooms with a kitchenette. That's where a family or a single woman goes. We have a huge waiting list because people want to come there. So when we're looking at the Enterprise Village, we're not going to have a shelter there. We're not going to have a congregate shelter. We're going to have individual rooms where people who are mentally ill are comfortable going, and they have their own privacy. They can lock the door. So I think the congregate versus non-congregate shelter is something we need to be talking about. And yeah, we have open beds, Brian, on the men's side, but never, never at the Village. We have hundreds of people on the waiting list trying to get in there. So I think that's something we need to be thinking about, is how can we convert some of the shelters into more dignified, private, non-congregate type facilities. And then you would get people who won't come in, will come in. And then we do have to lower barriers. And it is still a philosophical conversation, because when we've talked in city council about harm reduction, city council is like, oh my gosh, we can't have people sharing needles or not sharing needles, but helping people by giving them needles. I mean, harm reduction is still very controversial in certain cities. And so to do, you know, a low barrier shelter, you have to let people come on without drug testing. We stopped drug testing about 5 years ago. We stopped drug testing. That was a huge fight with our board. I'm not going to lie. A huge fight. We had to do a pilot. We had to show there wasn't going to be any more incidences. So there is still that philosophical issue around, you know, are we going to let people come into a shelter who are actively using? Well, I mean, yes. Everybody, you know, if you're not testing, you know, that's what you're doing.
Yep.
And so that's what we have to be doing. And so just something else to consider, you know, certain shelters around the country, which are wet shelters, actually let people come in with alcohol on their person. And then none of the shelters that I'm aware of allow people to come on their campus actually with drugs or alcohol. Anyway, I'm just pointing out that there is a little more challenge to this than has been discussed.
Yep. Okay, thank you. And actually, you know, trying to spur ideas for short-term recommendations, knowing that we have a limited budget and certain things can perhaps get done with the political will in the short term, but if we're talking about multi-year funding, that's the kind of thing that we'll probably have to get worked into a budget, be part of candidate discussions, all that.
Yeah, I fully expect a couple of things, and I appreciate the message. It's very clear to me. Shelter is not solution. Housing is the solution,
yeah.
And I think that's a long-term policy discussion that we need to do with a structure that supports it, both economic as well as infrastructure. But I think to your point, what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, if there's any way we can assist the existing shelters to create the less dormitory-like atmosphere.
Might be a good idea. Short-term
might be something we take a look at,
and
how we can incentivize those shelters to do that at the same time, perhaps relaxing some of the barriers that have in place. Mr. Oliver makes a great point. As much as I'd love to see him converted to a faith-based guy, he probably already is. He doesn't need to have that requirement placed upon him in order for shelter.
And here's the here's the other thing. When we talk about this, we have to fully understand if we convert any shelter or shelters from a dormitory congregate situation to less congregate or rooms, we will lose beds, right? Because that is the way they were built, they were configured to put the maximum number of people in the square footage.
Sure.
When we talk about non-congregate settings, that is each individual or household is using or allocated, if you will, at least 150 to 200 square feet, because that is just the way that room with a door needs to work.
Yep. What are some other ideas for? Oh gosh, we'll start right here.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit. Paul Stassi isn't here for City Rescue Mission today, so I had the honor of serving on their steering committee for their next 25 years, and I can tell you one of the things that I find that really impresses me is that they have their crisis center downtown, but then they have their campus. So if you are someone who has drug, alcohol, mental issues, you need extra help, there is that campus to where you can go to. We are talking about trying to find land to purchase and actually build family housing, because there is an issue when you are a family, you can't put them together. So we are looking at those things. But I do know that for City Rescue, I don't think we take a lot of, I think we have mostly private donations, I think, is where City Rescue comes from. But 100%. I think the model that they have, their Life Builders program, which if you haven't gone to and toured, you really should, because they work with local doctors, local dentists, local hairstylists, where you're giving dignity back to people as you're rebuilding them and helping them to learn how to interview, learn how to get into a work program after you've gone through their Life Builders, and I believe it's an 18-month program. I don't know how many beds they have. Cindy probably knows more because her and Paul know each other well, but I do know that when I volunteer down at the Life Builder program, you see those lives change, and it's they're focusing on everything, and they're working with local business people to come in. And I think when you're talking about immediate solutions, I really feel like you should open up to businesses.
Yep.
There are businesses, especially downtown, that would benefit to help the homeless, because even driving here, I saw no less than 10 on the streets on the way here once I got past the bridge. So it's right here in our downtown. You have local businesses. You have DIA. You have downtown Jacksonville. These are massive groups of people who have helped do a lot for us, but I think there's more we can do. So I just wanted to throw out for immediate solution is work with the businesses because they want to help.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. I think I have that's a great idea. So we've explored the shelter capacity utilization issue. I think we've beaten that one to death.
Let me walk you to another one in the context of the long-term solution. And I'm sure Donald and Cindy and Shannon may roll their eyes, but does it make sense for the city to appropriate a certain amount of funds to formalize the work of developing a long-term strategy to create both a funding structure and or a housing structure?
I would completely support the city utilizing funding to develop a long-term strategy.
Because I really think that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well,
as Shannon so eloquently put, like, my job is to focus on homelessness, right? That is, as the lead agency, I have the privilege and sometimes the frustration. That's what I'm going to focus on. Shannon is a nonprofit developer. She is going to focus on building, and she does it really well, but that's her focus. Cindy has multiple focuses, but federally qualified healthcare clinic, right? Like that healthcare piece, she comes in. None of us have, let me put it a different way. There's a very different attendance response if the city council calls a meeting than if I do, or Cindy does, or Shannon does.
As evidenced by this efforts overall.
I agree. I mean, that definitely has to be a component of our recommendations coming up, but it cannot be the only component. There's one thing I hate about government, and that is that to set up a study to come up with a plan, you know? I hate that. In the meantime, I mean, and in this case, it can't be more poignant that we do something now because we're about to have another storm come. Say we have 300 people right. that are running around. They're going to get rained on in the next couple of days. So, you know, I think from a short-term solution, sure, let's put money towards developing a long-term multi-year funding plan. But there's got to be something we can do now. And one thing we haven't talked about is diversion, but that's come up multiple times during our working.
So there's diversion. There's a couple different things. Diversion is something that we could step up pretty rapidly. Diversion is literally the people, right? So we have worked actually with the city. We have a small three-person, we call it a problem-solving team, that just started October 1st. That is not enough to do community-wide diversion, right? Three people with the fire hose of need that we are seeing at all of our front doors. But diversion generally, if done well, can divert somewhere from 10 to 30% of the individuals away from homelessness.
Ms. Dunn, what do you mean? Well, give me a clear...
Okay, diversion. So someone literally shows up at one of the shelter. They firmly believe that they cannot go back to wherever they were last night. But we have someone there. Before we do an assessment, before we start doing our 17 HUD-required questions, like all that stuff that we ask the question, why are you here? Right? So where were you last night? Examples of folks that have been diverted. I live with my grandma, but I promised her I'd do this, and I didn't do it, and so she kicked me out, so I can't go back. Right? Can I call your grandma? Can we talk? What did you promise her? If it was I would get a job and I would contribute it to the food because she's also got, you know, two other grandkids there, right? Can we, like, so it's and I made it sound super easy,
prevention.
Right? Like in 15 minutes. Generally, these are very long conversations because first you have to build the trust for the person to tell you what actually is going on. So it is that it falls in between prevention and what we would call rapid rehousing or rehousing, because that person, when they're showing up at the shelter or they're showing up at the urban rest stop or they're showing up at our door, they genuinely believe they need an emergency slot tonight, and it's before they even go there. Can we divert them out? Now, sometimes we'll actually, because it's, you know, 5:15 on a Friday, we will find a spot in a shelter for them and come back that next Monday and say, talk to me. Talk to me about what's going on. Can we help you solve the immediate problem?
Are there awareness programs that you've seen in other cities, a diversion preventative program that help, like, you know, flyers or public service announcements saying, are you at risk of losing...
I
your shelter,
would absolutely
call
not do that.
1-800.
So I can show you on my phone just like the volume of people that reach directly out to me.
Yeah.
Right? Like if you get to me, you've done some work to get to me and you've probably gone through all these other resources. Where diversion works and problem solving work best is when it is embedded at the front doors. Right? So at the places, if you think you need help, you're going to show up at. It could be emergency shelter. It could be the urban rest stop. We have a front door for that people literally knock on and are seeking help. It's when you have capacity there to have those conversations before you immediately start, like, tonight you'll go to, or what do we have left? So diversion is something that can work well.
But it's not as upstream as I'm saying it needs to be. It's more at the door.
It's at the door. I get everybody would like to go upstream. I feel comfortable saying, like, the whole homeless system has been pushed underwater twice, and that would push us under for the third time. I mean, it would just, there's, when I say I get caught, like, the one lady that reached out to me, she was one of a dozen over the last 72 hours, right? So it's constant. I have gone to Sulzbacher. I know the calls that they get. I know the list that Ability Housing gets. And these are real people who really live in our community, and what they need is a place to live.
What I think I would say is, for diversion, you got to think of it as a triage. Mm-hmm. It's not somebody you're trying to help with their health, their heart care, you know, in advance so they don't show up in the ER. It's when they show up in the ER and how you keep them from being hospitalized at that moment. That's what diversion is. It's if, but for this one thing, at this moment, they will be homeless tonight. Because otherwise, what happened in the past, before we started seeing real reductions in homelessness, is the homeless system was used as a poverty alleviation. And people weren't necessarily at real risk of homelessness. They were poor and they had issues and they were in crisis, and we need to... But that's a different system of care. And if we start making homelessness about all human tragedies and crises, it becomes too big and it becomes unwieldy. And the reason I originally stepped up here is I do think a plan would be a great idea. I would personally like it if it was a really targeted plan.
Right.
Like, in the next 5 years, and for every 5 years thereafter, how do we reduce homelessness by 50%?
Yeah.
Well, then let me...
Not just, what do we do about homelessness? But yeah. I want you
actually...
to make a plan to reduce it by 50% in 5 years. 50% 5 years
after that. Yeah, I wasn't being as simplistic as that, but you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me bring this up as a matter of discussion. So United Way of Northeast Florida runs 211, which literally is a bunch of attendants there to help with all human tragedies. If you increased awareness among folks who are at risk of homelessness or homeless about the use of 211, could that take the burden off changing homelessness, because 211 folks are going to connect people with Catholic Charities or the Jewish Community Alliance, who may have money to keep people in homes, or, you know.
I'll take the hit on this one. So 211 exists. 211 reaches out to Catholic Charities and Jewish Families and the City of Jacksonville, and there are a certain amount of appointments that each of them are able to provide every week. Once those appointments are gone, and they're generally gone the day they come in, right? They're all filled up for the next week at any given time. Then they simply give out phone numbers for the person to call.
To you and...
To whomever is on the list.
Sulzbacher.
So, again, that the volume of people seeking help and the ability for us to manage that, it's two huge different things. To Shannon's point, there is a huge difference between preventing homelessness and preventing evictions. Both are important, but they are two different things. And we are incredibly bad as human beings in discerning between the two, because on the surface, they look a lot alike. The only real predictors we have of who will actually become homeless versus just get evicted and have friends or family or other people to help them is, have you been homeless before? Do you have experience with the child welfare system? After that, it just, you know, statistically, yeah, it's a little bit more for veterans, it's a little bit more, but it's not, those are the only two things, and they're not particularly great predictors. They're just the best ones we have.
The one thing I would say about 211, because, I mean, people do need a resource.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it goes back to what Don said before. It's a capacity issue. We don't have the service units available to help the people calling 211. It's not that they're doing a bad job. There's nowhere to refer them because all the slots are taken. But, you know, and this would be a huge lift for them, and they'd have to be willing to do this. You know, if they start getting trained in that diversion and mm-hmm. asking those questions, or maybe having specialists, so that rather than referring them to the other front doors, they become one of the front doors that help with an honest discernment of, is there some negotiation we can do with your grandmother? Or what about your uncle?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just for 3 nights, you can stay with your uncle and figure this out. So that rather than walking into the Sulzbacher City Rescue door and becoming literally homeless because you're in a homeless shelter, prevent it just a little while you try to come up with a self-resolution. that's what diversion really is. It's really, really helping people come up with the other solutions. That they're in such a state of crisis, they haven't figured out what they are, or they don't have the negotiation tools, and they need somebody to help them negotiate with their network of supports to help them not enter the homeless.
I mean, we've worked with United Way 211 to work on a veteran-specific program. So if someone calls in, they get referred to a handful of 211 attendants who are trained specifically on veteran issues to help get them through. Is there some way to work through and spend money to do additional training for them?
Absolutely.
Homelessness and chronic homelessness and at risk of homelessness?
And
issues?
It's asking United Way to change how they run 211, right? So again, if we do it, that right now 211, it's people call in, and there's an average number of minutes that they work with the person and answer the call. What we're talking about is allowing 211 to have enough attendants who are skilled in these open-ended questions and getting the information, and that they have as much, however much time they need to stay on the line, they can stay on the line, which is a very different model than what they have right now, because they have a certain number of attendants and they're taking all these calls, and they can see when all the calls back up. And there's pressure on those real people, again, answering the calls, trying to get to the next call, right? So,
how many homeless people have a mobile phone?
Most,
99%?
Most of them have a mobile phone, and it depends on the time of the month as to how many minutes are available. A lot of times we work case management via text, because that seems to be something that people have more access to. So it is extremely common for folks to have a mobile phone, but it is also common for the minutes to be gone or that phone to be cut off.
I won't really speak about this prevention. Stop. It doesn't work. You're beating a dead horse. Because when I say that, I mean the mess is very bad. And if you don't know people who come from low-income community, and you didn't grow up in that kind of culture, you're not going to get a lot of people that want to bring somebody that's really burned their bridges back into the house with them. The thing about it is that what we have a problem is that that Band-Aid on a leaky pipe, you can't continue to do it. Trying to do things that you can do with law enforcement and crime prevention and intervention, that can only carry you so far. We're dealing with the aftermath of a lot of poor policies from federal, state, local level. It's catching up with us because of economic inequality. That's what it boils down to. The thing about it is, this community is going to have to suck it up, come off that money, and let's take real responsibility for the things that are systematically focused. Now, y'all got, like Ms. Dawn, Ms. Cindy, all of y'all folks have the technical skills. Me, I have that real world skills. A lot of what we're doing now in this community, it does not work. You keep putting that Band-Aid on it, and that water main just keeps breaking. You're going to have to replace the pipe. Somebody's going to have to take responsibility. And the pressure's on us. I'm seeing the people. They're getting young, and they're so zooted out in their mind. Yeah, I got my hat, and I got my ways. But the one thing, I'm going to be honest, is that I'm seeing the cause and effects of things that we do not take direct action on. So everybody's going to have to take responsibility. We're going to have to build more houses. I know the targeted population, from what I'm understanding, is focusing on those that have easy access to mental health dollars. They reach a certain bracket where they can get Social Security that makes them economically efficient. But those generations that are a lot more younger, they're getting on these real hard drugs, and there's not enough taxpayer dollars on a federal level that can pay for a lot of this stuff, because we're dealing with a broken system. And if nobody takes direct action on a broken system, it's going to get worse and worse and worse. We're already at that peak.
Thank you, Carnell. So,
got a couple.
Yeah. Okay, good, Pastor Barlow. We have about 23 minutes. I'd like to leave 5 minutes for closing remarks and at least 10. I don't think anyone's filled out any speaker cards, have they? Oh, we have two? Okay, so we'll have to leave 10 minutes for public comment, which gives us about 7 more minutes of discussion. And I think we've gone through some short-term recommendations, potentially increasing awareness of shelters out there, not really one that we're interested in. We talked about transitioning some, helping our 5 shelters convert to more private, more dignified rooms. That might be something that we could be interested in. Diversion, we haven't really come up with any kind of solution there in the short term. So our 2 takeaways right now so far are, can we help the 5 shelters convert any individual rooms to private rooms to maximize their capacity? And also, let's put money towards formalizing a long-term strategy.
Can I add one more before you? Just because both Ability Housing and Sulzbach are here, there is one more short-term solution that I think really could be explored with a limited amount of funding. Both organizations do something called master leasing. Both are interested or have been interested in the past in exploring roommates or shared housing. This is something as rents keep going up. It is one way that for a year, if there was money to master lease, we could at least hold steady rents for a year. That is a possibility. They are the only two that I think do it on a fairly consistent, large enough scale to be able to give some more information about that. I know Cindy in particular has been very interested in how do we incentivize shared housing going forward. So that's another option.
So rent relief?
It's not rent relief. It's when a nonprofit master leases, the nonprofit says, we go out on the open market, we talk to landlords, and we lease from a landlord 5 units for a year at a set amount of rent. And then as clients get referred to us, they come in and live in that unit, and they either assume the lease at a period of time or they go out and find another place on their own. Am I getting this right, Shannon and Cindy? We don't actually master lease. We just look at other entities that do that. Like anything, it can, as Shannon, Shannon put it, it can be done really well or not so well, right? So there's why I'm pointing to them is they are in the community, they have worked with a lot of different landlords, and they understand the contractual obligations they would be getting into with master leasing.
I had experience in my district and some very upset neighbors because it was kind of out of control. There were 7-8 people living there. They were seeing vans coming and going in. It was well-intended, but it just didn't quite fit, obviously, to the neighborhood. But I'm not saying you shouldn't look at it. We just need to look at that with some...
Mm-hmm. But that, and again, trying to think of short-term, that's not going to... That you could do for a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we would like it for multiple years, but you could do it for a year and see what would happen. So... Thank you for your indulgence on that one.
Oh, no problem. Again, Alan Logan, I articulated my address earlier when I spoke, but I'm primarily focused on a long-term solution. And I have a slight disagreement with respect to modifying shelters. Shelters serve a purpose. What has happened is we're using them in a purpose that, in a way that they were not designed to be used. Some people were there for a long period of time, and they shouldn't be there. So I think if you modify what they're doing and you reduce the numbers of beds, you're going to probably pull them out of what they were really designed to do, which is to temporarily house people before they can matriculate into permanent housing.
Good point.
But my focus has been on several things. Number one, creating a recurring source of funding without raising taxes that will, number one, foster permanent housing, okay, above shelters, and then facilitate permanent support for those housing units. And so I've been pushing this button for a long time. And one of the things that I see in Jacksonville that we failed is there's an inequitable distribution of tax dollars with respect to health care, affordable housing, and I'm so glad that y'all separate the homelessness. That was the best thing I think y'all did as far as my participation in this is concerned. But just look at this. This is what we learned going through these meetings. The 2019 to 2020 budget, it was $82 million for health care, $56 million for affordable housing, and $5 million for homelessness. 2021, $119 million for health care, $98 million for affordable housing, $5 million for homelessness. 21-22, $105 million for health care, $23 million for affordable housing, and $3 million for homelessness. So some of these funds need to be redirected if you're talking about a temporary solution. But I'm concerned with a permanent solution. So I really appreciate you, Councilman Howland, your desire to do something quickly. I can discern it in your spirit, in your speech. And we need something comprehensive, and that's going to be on a long-term basis. And I appreciate Councilman Borland's perspective. I think he's looking towards a permanent solution. But I think that our focus needs to be on allowing shelters to serve their function, but having something in place where we can permanently house people once they go through that system and not allow them to live there for inordinately long periods of time. That's what Miami got away from. And so that's my perspective on it.
Thank you. And then I think, Sherry, you have a comment, and then after that, we'll go directly to the official public comment period where we do have two speaker cards.
Sorry, Sherry Weber. Just very briefly, and please stop me if you've already talked about this, but has there been a broader conversation about how to bring in the faith sector? Because I feel like we're overlooking a really large source of revenue and cooperation. And I'm speaking from, you know, personal experience that I think that, you know, we were talking earlier, does everyone in the homeless community, like, know about all the resources? And I'm hearing that, yeah, they're very, you know, familiar with that. And then we're talking about, do the businesses downtown, do they really know, you know, what's out there and how they can help? I think that we have a lot of churches in the faith community that want to do something but don't know what to do or how to do it that is going to be the most effective and bring the most relief or help, whether that's something short-term, long-term partnership, whatever it is. And I would hate to see us overlook something like that. And I know everybody immediately gets their hackles up because they're like, oh, you know, having faith and you know, city together, and everybody gets nervous about public-private partnerships like that. But surely there is somewhere, you know, in the U.S. where something like that is working. I mean, I don't know if we have any research to that effect. But that is I'm telling y'all, it's a huge resource that's sitting out there. These are people who their faith teaches them that they should be providing this type of relief. And so they're a ready audience. So I just want to put that on record.
Yeah, you can't be more right. I mean, to go to a personal experience with the Northeast Florida Fire Watch Council when they launched their early intervention upstream community network for people to learn the warning signs of veterans in crisis and to get veterans to the resources they need. The faith leader community has responded miraculously. Almost 3,000 people that have been trained in the community, almost 1,000 were led, brought to the program by the faith community. And that's because oftentimes people who are having issues, their first people they see on the front line are within their church or other element of the faith community. So great point. And with that, we'll go into public comment where we have two speaker cards. First is Pastor Barlow. Sir, and you got a full 3 minutes.
I won't take but 10. Okay. I think everyone knows the position that I've taken on having the DIA to reserve 5% of the grants and forgivable loans. That's money that doesn't have to be paid back. But I want to clarify something. This is not taking from the rich and giving to the poor, per se. The rich are already getting from the poor. Those are tax dollars that this money is coming from that they're getting. So what I'm talking about is specifically reserving a percentage of tax money that's going to rich people who really don't even need it. You know, can't think of the name of the organization. They made $2 billion, but they got a $40 million loan, grant, whatever it was from the city of Jackson. They didn't need it. All I'm saying, and that comes from taxpayers. So what I'm saying, all I'm saying is my position is that not on the loans that's going to be paid back, but on the grants and forgivable loans, I believe that we have a recurring source of income to do everything that we need that they've articulated so well and we've learned about it. And I believe Jacksonville has a unique perspective because we give money away to rich people. We call it economic incentives. Well, some of these economic incentives can go towards the poor in permanent supportive housing. And so I think that that is a win-win-win for everybody. And I think a lot of corporations would want to support that. You can articulate that to them however you want to. Would you be interested in supporting your community by allowing us to reserve 5%? You know, you can make it as lightly as you want to. Or you can say, look, a condition of this grant and forgivable loan is that we reserve 5% of this money that's coming from taxpayers to help people who are poor. So you can say it however you want to. But that's the gist of my proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Pastor. And now next up, speaker is Carnell Oliver. Please state your name and address.
Yes, my name is Carnell Oliver. Address is on file. I'm going to ask that straight up, either Mike, Michael, or Nick, one of y'all file Pastor Barlow's legislation. We don't need a point finger kind of approach of policy making, because I want y'all to get bigger clear of what mental health is, what economic oppression really does. It breaks down somebody socially. When I look at the system, I don't look at everything dollars and cents. I look at everything from a policy position. Right now, we need real financial appropriation dollars to deal with policies that have created this problem. Now, when it doesn't make sense that a single parent work two jobs, she has to make a choice between health care, she has to make a choice with paying the rent or paying a utility. We have an economic structure system problem. And right now, you're trying to find priorities where you somehow, somebody can manipulate the system so that you can take advantage of programs like Social Security for those old folks or the VA dollars. I'm not trying to put nobody against one another, but I'm just being upfront because this is a money game. And it's about understanding that we're not getting enough money, or we're not creating enough money in this community where we can deal with our own problems in the most effective way. So if anybody wants to be bold enough, file Barlow's bill, right along with a number of our different organizations that y'all setting the pieces up for a bigger chunk of the apple. I see that clear out. You're already putting the pieces in place. But the thing about it is that we need to make some more money. And those at the top need to pay more money, because this is where the economic oppression is coming from, the inequalities, the mental health, because people's lives are being stressed out. But you want to make it about self, about individuals. That's not working when you have a system that's been designed to hurt people. Everything that we're going through right now is catching up with us. It is what it is. I yield my time.
Right on cue, 2 minutes, 45 seconds. Thank you, sir. All right. Well, with that, I think this was a fantastic discussion. It became clear to me that our leading short-term recommendation is probably to develop, fund some study to develop a long-term solution. In the meantime, I really would like to explore diversion a little bit more. I do think that leveraging downtown businesses, leveraging the experience of the so many important players in the homelessness sector within Jacksonville, including the five shelters, we can come up with some creative solutions that make a difference right away. And, of course, we've talked through it. It's up to the five shelters and their boards to determine whether they lower barriers and whether they seek city funding to shift how their bed structure might be. But that sounds like an individual or a private organization decision. in the meantime, I think we have our marching orders for moving forward. And with that, I want to make quick closing remarks, and then I'll turn it over to Dawn and then to Councilman Boylan. But I just want to say thanks for everyone's participation. Your input has been remarkable. Special thanks to Dawn, who's brought your expertise to the table in a big way and did so much preparation for all five of these working groups to get us to the point where we are. I think someone said during the public comments that we had some of the most informative meetings. That was due to your hard work. So thank you so much for doing that. Yeah. And with that, I look forward to working with the Planning Council and Regional Council and seeing what our results are going to be and what we're going to brief to City Council on December 13th and working with Dawn to get to that point. So thank you, everyone, for being part of this process. And over to you, Dawn.
All right. Thank you. And should we move forward with a study, I volunteer that we will give you all of our studies, including all of our unmet needs for the last couple of years. This really is... We are not planning a manned mission to Mars, right? Like, this is a very straightforward issue, and it can be figured out with political and community will. I'm not saying if we choose to move forward with something big, it'll be smooth and easy, but I do think in the end it will benefit the entire community. So I am excited on both a short-term idea. I know different agencies have tried diversion at different times. We are all open and interested in figuring out what that would mean to make it more broad. I think we are all very interested in trying to do a longer-term solution. As Shannon said, you know, in a previous election cycle, I literally put out, this is what it would take to reduce unsheltered homelessness by 50% in 5 years. Part of this is a person equation, and part of it is a math equation. If that is the goal, like whatever the goal is, we can. There's expertise in our community on how we can get there, but it does need to be a community goal, a full community goal, not just a homeless sector provider goal or a city goal. But what does the community want, and what can we put behind it? So I look forward to finding that out.
Thank you. I really appreciate, first of all, you know, Noel and the Northeast Florida Regional Council for the work they're doing and the onerous task ahead of them pulling all of this together. And I think you've got some good ideas out of today's meeting. I want to thank those who have been here on a regular basis. And, of course, the leadership. Dawn, thank you so much. I was so pleased when you said yes. And, Nick, I'm so pleased that you said yes because you two made a great team in this process. It's pretty clear to me, the consensus of this room is that a dedicated funding source is going to be required. The question is, what is it and how do we get there? And I don't know that we have too many bites of this apple. To your point, Dawn, you've tried this before and without much success. And I think we need to be careful as to how we do it. Pastor Bottle suggested perhaps the idea of putting a referendum on the ballot in May. Not a bad idea. We need to take a look at it, but we need to be prepared to answer the question. I think we differ a little bit with respect to my idea of a referendum isn't say to do this and do that. It is, do you support the effort of a sustainable public source of funding to address homelessness if it becomes a referendum? If you get into details of where that money's going to come from, it's going to be a lot harder. So politically, in my mind, a novice politician still, that, to me, simple is the best solution in getting the answer to that question. But be that as it may, I will leave it to the full group to make a decision, or an individual councilman as to, or member, to make a decision as to how they want to posture this. And likely I might do that as well, but we'll see where that plays. I talked a little bit about this at the front end. My experience in working with the long-term recovery, the difference between relief and recovery, I learned a great lesson during Irma. A lot of folks are very quick to step up to the plate and help during relief, which we're talking about sheltering in the situation, short-term situations. But recovery is a long-term. It's always a marathon in the process, and you need to be committed to it for a long time. And I think we have success, and why I ask us to explore a structure that provides the opportunity for those entities to come together to do this collectively. We found that to be a very successful model for us and securing the support necessary to literally help thousands of families in the Jacksonville area who were impacted by Hurricane Irma. So I'm giving away a little bit of my thoughts in this process, but I do believe it's very clear that the magnitude of the issue here is significant, both on a personal basis, but on a numbers basis as well. So we need to continue to do this work. Appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will adjourn the final working group of the homelessness, final working group meeting of the homelessness subcommittee and the special committee on critical quality of life issues. Thanks, everybody. It's such a mouthful.
No, it is.